Hi everyone and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Everyone, and welcome back to Pixels, the show where we cover the news from the video game industry from the past couple of weeks or so. My name is Patrick Beja, and today I am welcoming to the show a first-timer for this show, but you've been on my French gaming show a few times because you are French, so we're going to be two French guys speaking English on an English language show. Hey, Thomas, how's it going?
Hello, Patrick. Pretty good. Pretty hot today, but surviving.
Yeah, and I asked you to turn off your fan for the recording, so I'm contributing to your hotness, if we can put it
okay.
Like that.
I'm happy to sacrifice a little bit of comfort so I can talk with you. It's all good.
So you're Thomas Bideau, for those who don't know. You are an analyst, and you're one of the, I would say, handful of video games analysts whom I follow and trust. There are a couple of others that I welcome. I'm lucky enough to have on my shows from time to time. But I'm really glad you're here because we're going to be talking about a number of numbers, and you're going to help bring some clarity to those, which ones are interesting, which ones are BS, and which ones could be extracted information from. So looking forward to hear what you have to say about those.
Yeah, exciting stuff this week.
Yeah,
for sure.
The Valve leaks, the Fortnite study thing, Sensor Tower estimating stuff for Super Mario Run, etc., etc. We will get to that, but first, I did want to talk about Warframe. And Warframe is a game that came out, what was it, 2013, I think? And that I think everyone has been talking about on and off every year or two. And it's been, I'm gonna confirm it was 2013. I think it came out a few months before Destiny. And the comparison with Destiny is apt because it looks like Destiny visually and gameplay-wise. It's kind of a Destiny-like game. And so it's been around for a long time, for 5 years. It's expanded, changed tremendously. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's going to be coming to the Nintendo Switch, courtesy of Panic Button. Panic Button being the wizards who actually made it possible to have Rocket League. Well, I mean, Rocket League, you could have expected it would be available on Switch, but then they converted Doom, and I believe they're the ones who made Wolfenstein 2. And now we haven't seen it yet, so we don't know how graphically faithful it is to the original, but they're porting Warframe as well. All of those, or at least the last three, are games that are graphically pretty intensive and that I would never have guessed would be possible to do on the Switch without, you know, obviously there are some graphical downgrades, that's to be expected, but the fact that they would run at all with something that is vaguely comparable to the big boys versions is some kind of, as I was saying, it feels like wizardry. So I don't know what magic spells Panic Button are using, but they're also converting Warframe to the Switch, which is it, I mean, were you surprised as well that those games could be brought to the Switch? I was like flabbergasted. Now I'm getting used to it, but
yeah, I think I was surprised. I think the first hint of the Switch kind of bringing these sort of games in terms of you know, fidelity, environment was when they were kind of like leaking images of Skyrim without telling that Skyrim was coming to the Switch.
That's true.
And yeah, I was kind of impressed by that. But now, I mean, Warframe is impressive, but the fact that, you know, Fortnite, which is a much more recent game, kind of like released on the Switch, plays
yeah,
really
that's
well.
True. Fortnite as well, yeah. But Fortnite has cartoony graphics, but still, it's pretty faithful.
Yeah, it's very stressful. There's lots of the multiplayer is always complex because you need to have like something that can render like the customized characters with a long line of sight over a big environment. So these things are technically complex as well. Warframe in the way, you know, we have lots of corridors, so there's a lot of occlusion. You can do a lot of optimization. That's not easy, but the game is 5 years old. You would say it's probably a from a technical point of view, they had more time to optimize how they want to do things. But yeah, that kind of a whole sort of high resolution, high fidelity games, like 3D environments, 3D shooters, games that you would associate usually with either kind of high-end PC or, you know, PS4, Xbox One.
Yeah.
All those games coming to the Switch is very interesting. I think it's great for the console because it positioned them differently than previous generations of Nintendo consoles. And it's kind of like, this is a serious contender on many more levels than the previous generations.
I think it's a pretty big deal for the Switch because they I mean, Panic Button, again, praise to that company. I was going to say praise be. I've been watching The Handmaid's Tale too much. That company specifically is doing some incredible work. And the fact that they are able to port those games means that at least this generation's games that are not the most graphically intensive can be ported. Now, we'll see what happens in a couple of years when we have another generation. That will be an entirely different story. But for now, it makes the Switch into something more than it was envisioned as by the gaming community. The other really interesting thing, by the way, is that this is going to, again, bring up the question of cross-platform play. Sony is going to be, of course, the game is not as popular as Fortnite because nothing is as popular as Fortnite, but this is going to bring it up again. So I think whenever they're going to be releasing it, we don't have a release date, I believe, but whenever they're going to be releasing it, I hope Sony has an answer for those questions because it's going to, as I said, it's going to bring them up again.
I'm very confident that Sony's answer is going to be the same as it's been for the past, you know, couple of months. It's interesting because it reminds me of the PS3, Xbox 360 generation where it was Microsoft who was playing hardball about, you know, playing ball with the others and being, you know, playing hard to support something in the ecosystem where others would benefit from
yeah, if the other ecosystems would benefit, they. But yeah. I mean, the Sean Layden has said we're working on something and we'll have something to say. You know, recently, a couple of weeks ago, a little bit less. So I don't know what they're going to have to say, but they did indicate that they would have additional maybe changes to their policy, which wasn't necessarily expected, but
I want to see it. There might be. It's not impossible. I think in many ways, Sony is a bit more flexible when they make their policies than a company like Microsoft. But I see no concrete, real pressure from the market for them to change their positioning, especially as they crossplay with PC, which is the one platform where it's more easy for them to say yes.
Sure, but I mean, the consumer pressure, especially with Fortnite, is very strong. And that's what's pushed them to speak up about it already a couple of times. So I think, and the other thing, maybe you can enlighten me about this. What is the competitive advantage they have for this generation in not allowing this? I understand that they want to protect their, you know, business model by, not their business model, but a portion of their business by saying, hey, if you want to play it on PlayStation, you have to buy it on PlayStation. And the fear, I suppose, is the same as the App Store, which is you can't use in the game something you've bought somewhere else, because then let's say they might sell it on their own website. Epic might sell items or season passes, or I'm sorry, battle passes on their own website, for a cheaper price and then, you know, forego the Sony cut of the thing. Is that the reason?
No, so I think there's two components. One component is the crossplay, the ability to play with someone who are on a different platform. And then the second component is protecting the way they see it, protecting their store and making sure that, you know, their customers are charged even if they move on to one of the other compatible platform like PC or mobile. On the crossplay.
Yeah, but how is it different if that happens on Xbox than if it happens on PC? You're right. I mentioned they would want to only sell you stuff on the PlayStation Store, but you can already buy stuff on PC. So and they have the biggest market share anyway of the consoles. So it's not like people would buy stuff on the PlayStation Store in larger quantities than it's not like every player would rush off to the Xbox Store to buy stuff to play them on the PlayStation 4. I don't understand why they're so attached to it. I don't see the advantage.
This is very much. So they don't see PC as a competitor. For them, PC is not a competitor because they see them as different players altogether. But they see Xbox and the Switch in many ways as it's like it's not a zero-sum game. It's like you play if you open the window of you being able to switch from PlayStation to Xbox, then I open up the window to potentially lose you to another ecosystem. So it's playing hardball to suffocate the options.
I don't think it's working.
It's not nice to the consumer. They don't want to be nice to the consumer. So it looks like very aggressive because it is. Because
no, I understand that, but I think it's flawed reasoning. I think that is not helping them.
I agree.
I'm not
saying this is the right logic.
Yeah, but
I'm
that's their thinking. Logic. Yeah, that's okay. All right. Well, anyway, we talked about it already, and I still don't think it makes sense. And I think it's I don't tend to get angry about these kinds of things, but this one does make me angry. Oh, and by the way, Warframe, getting back to the topic at hand, I was comparing it to Destiny because it is very, very much like Destiny. It feels like a competent, poor man's, much more expanded Destiny. I say poor man's because it is free to play. Well, yeah, but that's not why I was saying this. It's free to play. It's very well done. It has some issues. I think the gunplay is nowhere near as satisfying as the one in Destiny. I've only played a few hours. I've played maybe, I don't know, 5 hours, something like that. But the gunplay immediately feels great in Destiny. It doesn't really in Warframe. It's kind of a random generic shooter in many ways. And the free-to-play nature, I mean, the netcode is not great. I've seen so many, like, so much rubber banding for enemies and for co-op team people. It's not the best design. And it's very confusing when you first get in. There's, like, a map that is the size of, I don't know, the entire... There are so many missions on the map and planets, and on each planet there's like 30 missions, and you expand the thing and it goes to the solar system, and there's like you can feel it's a game that has been expanded for 5 years, and you have like options and different weapons and different mods and the market and the I can't even remember all the names. It is confusing, but it's a very competent game, and they're supporting it super well. They've improved it very much. I actually played it in 2014, I think, and came back to it now. I've come back to it like every couple of years since, just to try it out. I was never completely convinced. If we didn't have as many incredible games, I think this one would be might become one of my games of choice. It's just we have other stuff that I'm interested in, but it's very competent.
I think people talk a lot about Warframe right now because of the Switch port, but this is a game that suffers from a lack of visibility when it's actually incredibly popular. I don't have the numbers top of my head, but from Valve every year release the top games from in terms of sales, and they do like, you know, there's like platinum, gold, silver, mm-hmm. and they all correspond to a number of sales for that year, kind of like, you know, like platinum disc, you know, that's the equivalent. And then Warframe, if I remember correctly, was one of the very few kind of like independent game, because I think the company has been bought since then, was in the platinum category on Steam.
Right.
It's an incredibly popular game. Lots of people are playing it. Lots of people are spending money on it. But we don't hear much about it most of the time, even when there's an expansion. So the announcement that was done was during their own event. They have their own...
Yeah, TennoCon.
TennoCon. I was going to say their own BlizzCon, but that's the proper name. And this is a very well-followed event. There's people care about the announcement they make. They have their own very dedicated community. And it's actually a significantly popular game. In many ways, for me, you talk about Destiny, and I think it's interesting because if you look from, like, you know, core gameplay loop, Destiny is much more tight. Like, you know, you're talking about the gunplay, talking about, you know, like...
It's a more focused experience. Like, it feels more polished.
It's very pretty. The character design is amazing in Destiny. I like the character design in Warframe, but it's, you can see like the team behind Destiny is Bungie. They have way more people. They have a lot of experience. There's probably a bigger budget behind it.
It's funny, even graphically, it feels like some kind of a Destiny, again, a poor man's Destiny. I was playing it. My wife showed up in the office, in the home office, and she was like, "Oh, you're playing Destiny again?" And I was like, "No, this is Warframe." But even, you know, from afar, you might think, "Oh, that's the same game."
But you're right, and it's interesting because Warframe came out before Destiny, so the art style kind of like I don't think was influencing that. But I think Digital Extremes, the developers of Warframe, do something much, much, much better, which is bringing life to the game with the live development, really embracing that game as a service, bringing new expansion all the time, so they're not perfect. They make mistakes. Their community is very vocal about those mistakes when they happen. But you look at the couple of mishaps that Bungie had on switching from Destiny 1 to Destiny 2, from the way they manage the expansions.
And by the couple of mishaps, you mean the 54 mishaps that they had.
I was trying to be diplomatic
to be gentle?
About it.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. and it's interesting to see that Warframe not as a polished experience, but you'll realize that you can have a slightly unpolished experience, but if you have a good service layer, if you bring constant content to your players, engage with them, you can be incredibly successful. I think a good parallel, and these two games are, in many ways, in my mind, they come up together very often, is Path of Exile and Warframe. I've managed to kind of like follow the same kind of route in the studio, making a game on an established genre, going free to play on something that was not free to play before, and by, you know, sticking with it, creating content regularly, engaging with the players, managed to build, you know, something very nice and successful. And that's something to praise. And that's something that I think Path of Exile is a little bit better than Warframe in that sense. In people seems to, in my circle, mention it more often. But I think we should be more attentive to what they've done and what they've successfully done, and how it can become like a path to, you know, like get inspiration from.
And, you know, you're mentioning the Valve numbers, and this is a great segue to the leak that happened just a few... Well, not really a leak. Basically, there was a setting that allowed people to view achievement numbers in Steam, which helped them determine the number of players estimate from each game. It was a little bit more complicated than that, but for the sake of argument, let's say we now have the all-time player estimate for every game on Steam. There's like 13,000, I think. And we can see which ones had how many players. Warframe is number 8 in that estimate with 16 million players. You know, for a game that is barely mentioned when we talk about the successful games, it's really worth pointing out. And by the way, number 4 is Unturned, which is a free-to-play game, which I had never heard of. Never.
I had heard of Unturned because of that, because it's a kind of a unconsidered game that's actually been incredibly popular on Steam. 2016-2017. I think it's not coming up as often now than it was like 2 and 3 years ago. But yes, there's a number of these odd game that are, you know, below the radar, but there's an engaged community and many players are playing them, and it's refreshing to see those numbers, because you can see those games emerge. And if you look at before Steam Spy had their methodology kind of like hindered by the new settings in the Steam API and the Steam platform, you could see these games, but because the way Steam Spy is an always available data set, you have very few people kind of like, oh, I wonder what kind of like surprising game is doing really, really well. But I think you could see Unturned already kind of like showing up in this numbers.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have expected something like that to show up at number 4 with 27 million players. Number 1 is Team Fortress 2 with 50 million players. CSGO is number 2 with 46 million players. And PlayerUnknown's Battleground has 36 million, and that's the number 3. It's not surprising for number 1 and 2, and the rest are games that you have heard about as well. But that leak was enormous, and you're an analyst who lives on data. Mm-hmm. Is this going to make you guys' your job easier? What is, like, is that going to change things? Is it a point of reference that's going to be useful in the future? Or is it like kind of garbage you can do anything with?
No, it's very useful. There's no doubt about that. That's so there was a time, long time ago, not that long ago, but there was a time where we had no data. There was no Steam Spy, for instance. And we were doing estimates based off Steam charts, number of reviews, and you were kind of like, I know this game made that much money and had that many units sold because they did a press release about it, or because you know the people working there, and so you can cross-reference. Steam Spy came along and kind of like, even if Steam Spy wasn't perfect, there was kind of like a margin of error that was acceptable enough so that you could get a sense of scale. Oh, that game probably, Steam Spy estimates at 100,000. You probably like, maybe it's half that, maybe it's twice that, but it's that range. It's really good to get a sense of, did they ever make money, or did they like flop? It's very, very useful. And then Steam's changed their settings. Steam Spy became a lot more unreliable. I know they're still working on a number of things to improve their algorithm. And then there's the what's called the data leak. I don't think it's something that always existed. The data was not leaking, which is like a very clever way to reverse engineer the numbers based on data that was made publicly available. So what's happening for us as analysts is like, we have now that snapshot, okay, July 2018, these were the numbers. It's very useful right now, and it's going to be super useful in the coming 2 to 3 months. And then the more time passes, unless something else come up, then the more the quality of that those numbers are going to deteriorate and will become less useful. But it's still so good to have a snapshot. We were guessing so much before having Steam Spy or these other methods of calculation. It's actually, I think it's a boon. And I hope we'll keep finding ways to see those numbers. What Valve is doing, though, what Valve publicly stated a week or two ago, They were at an event in Europe, I think, and someone asked, okay, so you've blocked the methodology for Steam Spine to make the calculation. As developers, we really, really need those numbers. It's very useful for us to, for our business, you know. It's just useful to raise money. It's useful to estimate our sales, to forecast marketing budget or anything, or even like development budget. And Valve said, well, we are working towards something like Steam Spy.
But more precise and more.
We don't know.
And well, that's what they said, I guess, but maybe...
That's what they said. So what I want to see is that, did they say that to basically push back on that very strong demand coming from everywhere in the industry? Even, I think I hear people saying, oh, it's the big publishers, they're putting pressure on people because they don't want to share the advantage, the edge they have because they have more numbers, because they know their own numbers. I think that's BS. I think everybody... wants to be able to have more visibility. I don't think we need the exact numbers, but what Valve is providing right now is nothing. What Steam Spy was providing was incredibly useful. And I've known big publishers using Steam Spy. I've known big publisher building systems like Steam Spy using the similar methodologies. And everybody's kind of like hungry for data, because data is kind of like feeding all sorts of positive endeavors, and making informed decision is so much more than guessing. And I
so
think
everyone needs the data. It's not just people spying on developers. Everyone needs those.
Absolutely not. There was a thread on Twitter from some prominent indie developers, and says like, oh, can you share stories about how SimSpy helped you? And you see those incredibly small studios and say, well, because of Steam Spy, I was able to convince a bank to give me money. I was able to convince like an investor to give me money. It's not necessarily like the startups that raise millions. It's also like small boutique
developer that asks for $50,000 or something. I guess.
And these people, if they go to the bank and say, the bank says, how many are you going to sell? Well, I'm going to sell that many. How do you know? Well, here are similar games on that platform I'm targeting. These are the numbers. And the banker is going to say, where are your numbers coming from? Well, here's like an established, you know, methodology. You can understand it. This is the estimates they have. Everybody in the industry is using it. Oh, okay. It builds confidence towards like, okay, you know what you're talking about. Your numbers make sense. I'll give you a loan. Just this is incredibly, incredibly valuable. And I think Valve, they've blocked the methodology from Steam Spy. They blocked that methodology that Arslan think I was talking about using the achievement. I think there's like pressure on Valve to provide something of that nature that helps people make informed decisions.
Really interesting, yeah.
And me as an analyst, if Valve doesn't do anything, it's a little bit good for my business, because I spend days, you know, scrapping data from other sources and do my own estimates. So
it's doing
me.
Your job for you. It's putting you out of a job.
Yeah, but to be fair, I'd rather be put out of a job of crunching those numbers and be the kind of guy who has a secret recipe who can like make good estimates about how many cells there are.
Right.
I'd rather have this data freely available to everyone and then get hired to help people understand the numbers. A good
put them in context
data.
And yeah
exactly, that would be so much more interesting to me than that. And so that's kind of what I hope will happen. That's what they said they were going to do, so we'll
have to
but
wait
it's a
and
very
see yeah.
Interesting, very interesting developments, because it puts really much more pressure on Valve than it used to be. And just to conclude on that, I think this, the other thing that asset does is, for someone like Sergey Galionsky, who does Steam Spy, that gives him like a data set to feed into his own database, create new reference point where he can like cross-reference, maybe do some machine learning to bring back Steam Spy. So I'm slightly hopeful that Steam Spy might come up again with a new methodology or more complex algorithm to keep us in the light of what's going on. I'm you know, as an analyst, I'd rather not do all that very heavy lifting that Stinpy is doing, and just like, you know, piggyback his work and do the other side of the work of an analyst, which is, you know, like you said, bringing context and helping going further into what the data mean.
Well, that's actually really interesting, especially the part about indie developers using that data to get loans. That's really is something I had never really thought about. But there are a lot of other numbers. We have Sensor Tower estimating Super Mario Run made $60 million worth worldwide. The 70% of the revenue was coming from Apple, with 33% coming from Android, of course, and then 43% of the revenue was coming from US players. So that's one piece of data. And then we have, for the celebration of the 10 years of the App Store, App Annie estimated the total revenue from all of the apps, and the most the biggest revenue was generated from games, of course, with the one at the top of the list being Clash of Clans, generating $4 billion from when it was launched in 2010 to today in 2018. So if you put the two together, you see $60 million, which is nothing to scoff at, but also you see Clash of Clans generating $4 billion. Is Nintendo happy with their numbers, you think? Were they hoping for more? And then, I guess, is everyone chasing Clash of Clans? I mean, obviously, Candy Crush is right behind it, and then you have other very successful games in Japan and in China, but...
I think Nintendo was hoping to make more money with Mario Run. I think they didn't lose any money with that, of course, with you know, the game. I think there's a lot of polishing to that game, so I don't think it was cheap to make, but it was cheaper than that. So they definitely made a profit. But if you read through Nintendo earning calls and the way they position themselves with free-to-play games, like even the performance of Fire Emblem on mobile, I think it's disappointing a little bit. It was very much an experiment, so I see.
Wait, do you think the performance of Fire Emblem is disappointing? I thought they were making
no.
For Mario compared to Fire Emblem.
Yeah, that's the way I was trying to phrase that.
Right.
So it's still good, but I think there was a bit of a notion of how much of the console effect can you get on a mobile and get people to get on board, and everybody loves Mario is going to play the game and most of them are going to buy it. It didn't happen in the scale they were hoping is my look into that. So I think this means that they are not necessarily going to pursue similar setups. I mean, Mario Run was very weird in its business model compared to what usually happens on the App Store.
Right, the free to try thing which they touted. And you have to think, if they don't manage to make a lot of money, you know, quote unquote, a lot of money with Mario, what other franchise is going to make a lot of money with that model? That was the maximum they could make, I imagine.
Yeah, well, when you look at the big Nintendo franchise, I mean, Pokemon has its own... through the Pokemon Company and Niantic, you know, that's the own thing going on.
I mean, if they're going to do it through free to try, meaning you have to pay one fee to unlock the full game, and I don't think they're going to try that too much again.
I don't think they're going to do that again. I think they will stick to, for anything that feels quote unquote premium, they would stick to consoles and their own consoles. And what they will do on mobile is what they've done with Animal Crossing, with Fire Emblem, and more like, sadly, more traditional free-to-play games on mobile. Fire Emblem was fine. I'm not a big fan of what they did with Animal Crossing. I'm not a big fan of what they did with Magikarp. It feels a little bit at odds with the brand of Nintendo. So I think it's a little bit uncomfortable for them, because they would love to have a premium experience on mobile, but Mario Run didn't transform in a large enough scale for them to justify to invest into like a Zelda game on mobile or something like
that. Right. But you don't think they would dirty those premium brands with free to play business models? Like they wouldn't do a free to play Zelda where they would sell stuff and energy systems and stuff like that.
I don't see them do that. I see them, there might be other franchises in the type of Fire Emblem where let's say the gameplay style, you know, that suites of characters that you accumulate kind of lends itself pretty well to free to play. Unless you have a franchise that is into that framework. And even like, you know, Pokemon would be into that, but they would probably stick to Pokemon Go for now.
I could see them go the route everyone else is going, following Fortnite, which we're going to talk about in a second, and do some kind of battle pass, like battle pass enabled game, because that's not as dirty as the usual free to play. And everyone is accepting of that model. So maybe, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. You might be onto something here. I could see this being considered and looked at. I think it does work with Fortnite, though, because of the multiplayer element and that kind of like very long replayability.
But sure, multiplayer Zelda on mobile. There you go. That's your game. Yep. I will be requesting royalties from Nintendo when they release that.
Absolutely. But I tell you what, I'm still so impressed by how successful Fortnite has been on mobile. If you had asked me, you know, like 9 months ago, how well I think it would have gone, I would have been very, very skeptical. I'm still surprised. I'm still shocked. I mean, it's not like I don't believe it. I absolutely believe it. It's just like, it's not something I saw coming. And, you know, it's true for PUBG as well.
Let's talk about this for a second. We did mention last episode that both of those games were actually mobile games now. They have the vast majority of their players on mobile, both Fortnite and PUBG. And to follow up on that, there was an analysis. What's the name of that company that released those numbers? LendEDU. That surveyed 1,000 players who play Fortnite and who released a number of pretty incredible numbers, namely the fact that 69% of those Fortnite players had made in-game purchases, and that they had spent on average, the people who did buy something had spent on average $85, which seemed like insane numbers. I understand you have the selection bias of asking people who already play the game and who play the game regularly, so they're engaged players. But even amongst a population like this, 69% is a crazy number. And you were telling me the methodology is kind of bullshit and those numbers shouldn't be trusted. But even if it's like a 40% conversion rate, and I can't believe it would be given the nature of the battle pass that is really attractive to players who are playing regularly, it's still impressive. But so you don't think those numbers are trustworthy, or?
So I mean, there's some elements of that study that are interesting, but the thing that people picked up in the headline, and I'm a bit disappointed by some of the trade media who decided to do the headline with 69% of Fortnite players are buyers. So it's a little bit worthless. Here's why. The methodology was people who self-identify as particularly active players on Fortnite were the respondents for the study. There's a confirmation bias. If you've already spent money on Fortnite, you are much more likely to consider yourself as Fortnite active players. There's no way to make anything with that number. It could be significant. It could be saying, oh, maybe it's 40%. It might be 10% of the people spending money. And we don't know. The variation is too big.
We don't have the similar numbers for other games to compare it to? Like those studies, we've never seen those studies done for other games asking players who self-identify as active players of those games?
No, you do your study based on people who have played the game. The benchmark is usually spent on, have you played that game? Yes or no? And then have you spent money on that game? Yes or no? And even the best study tend to go into There's a company called Superdata, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
They tend to not go into surveys, but they ask people the question because human beings tend to be fallible into what they remember. Even if you think you've spent something, maybe you didn't. Maybe it was another game. People make mistakes like that. And if you say, I think I spent $100 and then in reality it was like $250 or it was $10, we make mistakes all the time. Superdata methodology is looking at number of players and number of purchases made through metadata. And so it's much more reliable because you don't trust humans' opinion and or their fallible memory. To go back to your point in terms of what we see in terms of studies that are similar, we have numbers. We have things like a free-to-play PC game. The kind of like accepted numbers is usually you have like 8 to 15% of the players who are actually paying players. You have games that are like World of Tanks are known as exceptions with very high percentage of players because they have something like the pass with a subscription that's very, very enticing. But 30% is kind of like considered high in the industry. I would not be surprised Fortnite to be slightly less than 30%. If only because the audience skews younger than a game like World of Tanks. So I would imagine easily of all those players, which are a lot of them, there's a vast majority of them that just don't necessarily have a credit card. The parents don't necessarily let them spend money on that. And that percentage for me is probably below that kind of like current benchmark of 30% that's World of Tanks. For me, okay. It's probably between that, you know, kind of like 8% that you see in some free-to-play PC game, because that's a good benchmark to like 30% of the World of Tanks. And to be fair,
the seagulls are agreeing.
My seagulls? Yeah, that's part of the charm living by the seaside. I live in Brighton, if you're wondering. That's why there's nobody shouting about the French match outside of my door. The thing with those numbers, what's helping them is, I think this tend to be, if you go on console, people tend to be a bit more, it's easier to spend on console, and then mobile is even easier. So I could imagine easily that mobile is a good gateway for people to spend money because, well, you know, it's a couple of clicks, you know, it's like, you know, you already... Apple very nicely forces you to put a payment system when you create an account on iOS. And so, well, you know, there's that thing that's cute, kind of cute, and I have, you know, my card already on it, a couple of clicks. So I imagine it also helps Fortnite along, but I think that study itself on that number it means nothing. It's such a
I'm disappointed, but okay, yeah. Fair enough. Thank you for taking the time to explain it to the noob, the data noob and statistics noob that I am. Talking about Fortnite, I mean, they are definitely incredibly successful, especially in the way that they are engaging the communities. Have you heard about this ARG game that is happening right now?
I've seen something on, was it on Reddit, where the llama was found in France, was Cannes? Was it in Cannes?
Yeah, I don't think they've found it in France yet, but basically they are putting portion, like characters from the game. The first one might have been the first viewing or sighting of something like that might have been planted. It was the mascot from the Greasy Grove Burger, I think, which was in the desert somewhere in the US, and someone posted a photo of it. And then just 2 days ago, people started seeing Fortnite llamas in European cities, like in the actual cities, in the streets. The first one was, I think, in London or Germany, and there was another one. And people thought it would be in France, but then it turned out it showed up like in the Netherlands or something. And Fortnite Season 5 is beginning in just a couple of days. So this is a, marketing, PR, communications thing for the release of the new season, which of course you're going to have to pay for the season pass for, the mm-hmm. battle pass for. It is a stroke of genius again. It's so well done. It plays on every impulse of gamers that they want to have more to do with the game that they enjoy at that time. It's really well done. So just, again, wanted to tip my hat off to Epic, who are doing an incredible job with every aspect of this game.
I tell you what, Epic has been, I mean, Fortnite, before they went with the Battle Royale mode, because that's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't talk about anything else. They've managed to take an existing game that was kind of flopping in a very short time frame, develop that mode. That's actually pretty solid. I mean, they've done it like in 3 or 4 months to put it together and to do the first release. That's amazing.
That,
and I think it was, let's say 6 months maybe, but it's okay. It's incredibly quick. And of course, you know, Epic is very talented. They have lots of, you know, very good people working on the engine level. So they have a capacity that very few studios have. But I agree with you. I'm impressed with, okay, switching it around, see if you have a hit, take the ball and run with it in such a impressive way. I was impressed with the ability to make the deal with the Avengers and the Thanos mode so quickly when the game is still kind of like, you know, the paint is still wet, you know?
Yeah.
And then they...
I mean, it was everything. The business model was super well done. The communication around it was super well done. The way they're engaging the players in the game, changing the map from season to season with the cracks appearing in the sky and the, you know, things that are being rumored, like the tilted towers were supposedly going to be blown up by the big rocket. And it turned out that wasn't what was going to happen. And like, they're creating a narrative within that game that has no business having a narrative, but it's respectful. Of that silly 100 players come in and, you know, there's no story really, but they're building a common thread throughout the seasons and an evolution to get people, to keep people interested. I mean, again, everything, yes, there's a lot of luck and just happenstance. It just happens and you can't always control that lightning in a bottle effect. But then, as you said, taking the ball and running with it, in the perfect way, they're really incredibly,
and
like,
they're
to be commended. It's not just we copied PUBG and that's it. Like, they actively did a lot more to make the game that successful.
And they've managed to do that while running things at the same time in parallel. It's very easy for a game company, especially when that self-publishes, that's not known for its publishing arm. You know, Epic is known for development, its technology, it's not known for its marketing initially. They've managed to be able to have like parallel discussions to put things together and not lose any momentum from one to another. That Llama thing with, you know, things popping up all over up, you have a number of people working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not happening out of nowhere. And, you know, hit the right tone, go into the memes, like stay in tune with what the community is about. That's not easy. It looks easy because it's well done, but it's not easy. It's very difficult to actually engineer that, not be delayed, and you know, hit the schedule and always have those crazy things happening. And it's no surprise that so many, like, we almost have too many things happening on Fortnite. I'm getting sick of hearing about it. But at the same time, it's amazing because it's not just, oh, someone is writing yet another article to get, you know, their daily article on Fortnite to hit the number of views on their website. There's actual things happening.
You've
it's
been
just
reading
like,
Polygon.
I've not. You know me, I look at numbers and I see numbers of articles on Fortnite every month, and it's driving me crazy because it's so much all the time.
No, I kid. I mean, Polygon, and not they're not the only ones, but they certainly know how to push a game that is getting people to click. It's my main source of gaming information, by the way, so I love them. But that is, I think, the person who is in charge of communication on Fortnite should get a raise. However much they're being paid, pay them more because they are genius. All right, that is going to be it for the main topics. We're going to run through a few additional topics really quickly. The first one is that 20 minutes video of playthrough of Anthem, which, have you seen that video? Have you watched it?
I didn't watch the whole of it. I watched little chunks of it.
Okay. I would recommend anyone who thinks they might be interested in Anthem to go and watch the entirety of it. It's basically a 20 minutes mission commented by the developer. And it is exactly what they would have needed at E3. If the person in charge of comms for Fortnite needs a raise, the person in charge of the way Anthem was presented at E3 for EA needs to be slapped around the face with a fish. The presentation of Anthem was disappointing, confusing, chaotic, and ultimately, made the game, made people less interested in that game.
Yeah.
That 20, I think everyone agreed. And we kept hearing from people who had seen it in the live playthrough behind closed doors that the game actually looked great. Having seen that, I absolutely believe them. That video made me very, very hopeful for a game that takes what, there are still a lot of unknowns, but it takes what Destiny was and it still is in some respects, and evolves it into something really interesting. It is very like enthusiasm creating for someone who's interested in these kinds of games. And I'm not saying they should have played a 20 minutes video on stage, although honestly, if they had ended their show, their very poor show, EA's was not great, with, all right, thanks everyone for coming, now we're going to show you Fortnite, we're going to show you Anthem for 20 minutes, I think a lot more people would have made this game their game of the show. It was just go all in. This is your big game for the next calendar year. Just go all in and show it for 20 freaking minutes. It's not like your presentation was too long or anything. It was anemic. Anyway.
And in the past, I've not been shy of doing something similar with other games. So it's not like unprecedented. So, yeah.
It was just so... Like, retrospectively, I was hurt for EA for their E3 conference. But anyway, go check that out. Now I think this turned Anthem into a day one purchase for me. It's very possible I'm just gonna, I'll wait a little bit more to get confirmation, but I really want to give it a try now. Halo is going to get a TV series on Showtime, and Showtime has had a few well-crafted hits. I'm wondering, Halo is not an easy property to convert to a TV series because you can't really make it about the Master Chief because, it's going to mess up the lore, but it could be well-crafted and into the world of Halo. That would be really interesting. I just hope they don't make it too... like cheap, not in the budget sense, but in the hey, let's wink wink to the Halo crowd every 2 seconds.
My worry is that exactly that is like if they make it like a fan service, an only fan service show, then I have zero interest in that. If they make a good TV show, period, and it's just set in the universe, that's so interesting. But historically, it's so tempting for people to go into the kind of like safe zone and say, oh, well, will service the fan. Let's see. I think Halo is kind of like that emblematic property that people think know is very strong in the gaming side, but it's also a niche in many ways because it was an Xbox exclusive. There's lots of people who know about it but never got engaged with it. I think I have very ambivalent feelings about Halo. I don't think it's as big as people think it is because it became signature of a generation for console. So it kind of like blown up how important and or how well known it is. So I'm very curious to see how they tackle it. Could be really, I think they could do a good TV show on its own. That's the way to approach it. Easy for me to say, but
And I think, you know,
I'm worried about the fan service side of things. Yeah.
The thing is, the fans are going to be watching it anyway. At least they're going to give it a chance. So make it into a good TV show first and then link it to Halo. Well, respectfully, of course. But I'll check it out. Obviously, I'll be interested in something like that. And if they manage to do something good, then it opens the door for, you know, everyone's going to be searching for additional gaming properties to be done properly on TV. That could be really interesting.
Yeah.
Todd Howard is basically saying that Starfield, that, you know, next Bethesda game, is going to be a cross-generation game. He didn't say it quite like that, but it's very likely, like a few others, that that game is going to be releasing on this generation, but really it's being developed for the next generation. So, I mean, take of that what you will. It's not certain 100%, but it's not surprising either. It's just worth mentioning.
I think it's kind of emblematic. Slight aside, because, you know, talking about E3, I think Bethesda had a very weird E3 as well, where in the past they've been so successful about showing stuff that nobody expected, and like, and it's coming in 6 months. Oh my God, they have Elder Scrolls 6. They have Starfield that we don't know much about. It's too early to talk about them. I feel weird about that. And so the fact that the hinting of the cross-generation is just like, that was really too early. I'm kind of like a little bit baffled. I have my own theories of why they would announce things so early.
Please share.
Okay, I think they were not talking to the gamers. I think they were talking to investors and say, hey, oh, look. So there's the whole Facebook trial thing going on that you know, they didn't make as much money out of it than they expected to. That was, the result was announced, I think, a week after E3. I think it looks like...
Facebook thing?
Okay, so there's a trial between Facebook and Bethesda based on John Carmack's work when he was at Bethesda.
The code. The Oculus thing,
yeah.
Right.
Oculus, yeah, sorry. So it's all based on the VR tech. There was a first judgment that was passed that we're going to be given $500 million, and then there was an appeal. In the appeal, they said only $250 million. They also exonerated individuals specifically, like Mr. Irab, one of the CEO of Oculus, and Brendan Irab. I remember his name. The way I read it is kind of like, oh, but look, we have those fancy things coming up. You know, Elder Scrolls is so big. Blah blah blah. They showed they've literally had someone who could have potentially worked a day on that teaser trailer for Elder Scrolls 6, not telling you anything. And so not Bethesda. Bethesda is like Fallout 4. Well, it's coming. Like 6 months later, it's out. And it works so well for them. There's no reason for them to do that except talking to investment like people, I imagine. That's my theory.
Yeah, I could see that for sure, because it made no sense. And as many people have remarked, now every time they're going to open their mouth, everyone's going to be waiting to hear Elder Scrolls 6, Starfield. Why are you talking if you're not talking about those?
From the other titles that are absolutely coming sooner. Yeah,
absolutely. However, I think a lot of people are saying, oh, Bethesda does this thing where they announce a game and it's released 3 months later. They've been doing it for 2 years. It's not like, you know, Bethesda is an old company. They haven't been doing that for a decade. They did it for two E3s. So I don't know that it can be stated as it has been in the entirety of the gaming industry or the press. That is, this is not the Bethesda way. You don't establish a wave by doing things twice. That being said, I still don't really understand why they would announce those very far off games if you're right, if they weren't talking to investors.
You're right on the there's no established Bethesda way, but also it's very recent that they have just a press conference at E3. It's like it was the fourth ever, fifth maybe, fourth or fifth. So I think there's interesting things happening there. My theory is purely on Starfield and Elder Scrolls 6 is the real audience, the message that was sent was not to gamers. It was board of directors, investors, all sorts of things behind the scene, and that's who they were talking to. And now they have to pay the price with, like you said, every time they're going to talk about anything, they will be like, But Elder Scrolls 6 especially is such a kind of like iconic license for them. They call it Void true. Being asked that question. We'll see.
Maybe, yeah. And they were careful to say it's not even, you know, it's not even showable anytime soon. Like, this is coming after Starfield, which is also we're not showing anything about. So,
yeah,
we'll see. I mean, if it was just for investors, they could have mentioned them in an investor's call. They didn't have to make a big splash, or maybe they needed to do it at this point in time.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah. They're not a public company, so they don't have investors. It's a little bit more complicated for them, and so it might be people, like, you know, a belly dancing for them. Okay. And you know, just to go back on your initial point, which is the cross generation, it's kind of like hinting at we don't even know. Well, a number of people have like suspicions when the new generation is going to come, but there's nothing announced about when it is. It could be 2 years, could be 3, 4, 5. So the fact that, you know, there's just a hint that one of those two titles might be cross-generation is already kind of telling you, like, oh, it's really not now. It's kind of the subtext for me.
Okay. Well, we will have to see. But I mean, my guess is that they're going to pull a GTA 5 and release it first on this generation and then, you know, a year or two later when the next. But anyway, I mean, Starfield, again, you're right. We don't know when it's coming. So. There was a comment by, was it Duke Bowser, the actually his name, the marketing director for Nintendo US. He mentioned that the Nintendo Switch is being used docked and undocked at about the same rate. So it's over every player. Maybe some of them use it more docked than undocked, but it is being used docked as much as it is being used undocked. Which is really interesting because it really shows that Nintendo did tap into something that gamers wanted. If the console was being used docked only or undocked only, it would have been, you know, maybe they should have made a different type of console. But here it validates their concept very much.
I think it's interesting. I think it's so interesting, and I think it shows how clever Nintendo is, and I suspect not all of it, not most of it, but a good portion of it is of the undocked time is the second screen. You know, someone is watching TV and you just play in your bed next to them, watching TV at the same time, or you know, you have your partner sleeping next to you. You don't want to put the TV to wake him or up, and you just play on your small thing next to them. That's, you know, that's a behavior that was existing already with your phone. Kind of like switching into like
games.
So good. I big props on Nintendo on that generation. I think they'll be really successful with the Switch. We haven't seen the end of it, and I think that's one of the reasons.
I'm really happy that Nintendo is back. So happy. Can't wait for anyway. Okay. One thing that had me go a little bit was E3's press game of the show, which ended up being Resident Evil 2, the remake, which I understand why. I mean, they had to exclude the games that you couldn't play with a joypad in your hands. So, you know, all of the Cyberpunk, you know, Last of Us Part 2, Death Stranding, all of those were not in the running. But still, like, I know some people are very excited about Resident Evil 2 remake, but I don't know. It feels weird that the remake is getting game of the show for E3 2018. Maybe it's because I didn't love the game, but
feels weird. I don't have anything to say on that. I don't know how surprising it should be. I think it's interesting. Definitely make me a bit more curious about the title.
Everyone says it looks really great and there's a lot of nostalgia for Resident Evil 2. It's just I don't have a problem with remakes. Like, remake everything you want. I'm really not one of those people who goes like, oh, nowadays everything's a remake, do something original. No, there are plenty of original things. It's just that making it Game of E3 feels strange to me because it is. I mean, remakes, yes. Making them game of the show, and again, I understand it's because there aren't.
Is it symptomatic of what this E3 was. I mean, I was disappointed by this E3. I don't know what I was expecting. I was a bit like, lots of very cool game, lots of things coming up. But compared to, I don't know, previous couple of E3s, there was nothing as much standing out for me.
As explosive, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree, and so I agree. Maybe that's a symptom of that.
Possible. But there were still other games that could have been... I mean, anyway, they have to choose the game they think is worth it. And I'm sure they had those discussions. But anyway. So yeah, that is it for this episode. I'm looking to see if there's something else. But no, I think that's it. E3's game of the show was disappointing. I think they should have made it something else. As I said, that's going to be it for us. Thomas, why don't you tell people where they can follow your very enlightened teachings about the wonderful industry of statistical and intuitive analysis of the gaming industry?
I think they should look for me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Icotom, Icotom. That's the best way to look for me.
Excellent. And it will be in the show notes, of course. My Twitter handle is NotPatrick. You can find me under that handle on Facebook and Instagram as well. So go check me out there. And you can also find the show at FrenchSpin.com. Go check that out. Leave comments if you want to. Tell us what we had right and what we had horribly wrong. So let us know there. And that's going to be it for this episode. I'm a little bit tired. I apologize. I don't know where I am. That's life with a baby for you. We will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Bye, everyone.